Hola, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight Latino Voices. I'm Joanna Hernandez. Here's what we're looking at. What presidential candidates have planned for immigration reform and what's outlined in Project 2025. From apple juice to deli meat, there's been some major food recalls lately. A look at what's being done to help people access food locally.
The city's recycling rate has been stuck below 10% since 2016.
And we explain the history of recycling in Chicago. And now to some of today's top stories. The community is mourning the deaths of two students and two teachers fatally shot at Appalachie High School in Georgia. 14-year-old Christian Angulo and Mason Shermanhorn were killed in yesterday's mass shooting. Math teacher Christina Ermey, as well as math and football coach Richard Aspinwall, were also among those fatally shot. At least nine other people were injured and taken to the hospital. Police say 14-year-old Colt Gray used an assault-style weapon in the shooting and was taken into custody within minutes. Gary has been charged with four counts of murder and will be tried as an adult. And homicides in Chicago are down in August, but the number of people shot is up slightly. In its latest crime stats, the Chicago Police Department reports there were 51 homicides in August compared to 58 people killed last August. But there were 301 shooting victims last month compared to 274 the same month last year. However, CPD reports homicide shootings and shooting victims are all at their lowest level since 2019 year to date. And residents in West Garfield Park once again have access to a grocery store. That's after a Save-A-Lot had its grand reopening today, 2 years after the store was shut down for a rat infestation. Now Yellow Banana, the company that operates the store, works to gain back trust from the community amid an ongoing lawsuit filed against them by suppliers and recent financial issues. The location is the first of six Yellow Banana-owned stores across the south and west sides, slated to be renovated and reopened this year. However, there's been numerous delays in reopening the stores. The company has received $13 million from the city to reopen the locations. Up next, what Project 2025 could mean for immigration reform. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
From mass deportation to a pathway to citizenship, immigration has been a defining issue in this year's presidential campaign. And while Donald Trump has attempted to distance himself from Project 2025, the conservative playbook written by some of his key allies outlines recommendations like increasing detention facilities and terminating DACA status for Dreamers. Kamala Harris has advocated for the bipartisan immigration reform bill that was proposed this year but never made it to a vote. Joining us to dig deeper into this topic are Chuck Hernandez, chairman of the Chicago Republican Party and former detective of the Chicago Police Department, and Dulce Ortiz, president of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights and executive director of Mano a Mano Family Resource Center. Now, thank you both for joining us. There's a lot to get to. Chuck, I want to start with you. It's no surprise that immigration is one of the country's most complex issues. What is the Republican Party saying the U.S. needs when it comes to immigration reform?
We need to, number one, secure our border. That's the main issue. We're having a flood of illegals coming into our country. Some would say upwards of 10 million. And this is just unsustainable, both financially and it's just we cannot go forward like this. We need to start enforcing the border.
And talking about that, we know former President Trump has stated he has nothing to do with Project 2025. Some of his former advisors, like Stephen Miller, helped draft the document. What do you think of some of the ideas outlined for immigration in the document, like mass deportation to terminating several programs?
Some of these issues he's talked about himself on the campaign trail. Obviously, he's not embracing Project 2025, so I'm not familiar with all the outlines in Project 2025. What we like to call it is America First Agenda. That's what it's called. And so we're going to get back to protecting the American citizens. And right now, under Biden and Harris, American citizens are not safe.
What does it mean by what do you mean by saying America's first agenda? What does that look like?
Yeah, protecting American citizens, following the law in our country, which means enforcement of our immigration laws. We have immigration laws on the books. We're not enforcing them, and that's why we see a lot of chaos in our cities.
And Dulce, going to your organization's mission is to empower immigrants so they can become active participants in the communities. What reforms do you think that are needed?
Well, obviously what we've been asking for a long time with ICER and member organizations like Mano a Mano, it's a pathway to legal citizenship, stopping deportations, and also not making it difficult for people that are coming to the borders that are seeking asylum because they don't feel safe in their countries anymore. Unfortunately, we've been working very hard on these issues on the federal level, sadly to no avail, but at least here in the state of Illinois, we have been able to make Illinois a welcoming state for immigrants.
And what concerns you about Project 2025?
There is a lot of concern. I believe that this is a blueprint to terrorize and also to punish people that are not white supremacists, pretty much. Let's just name it what it is. I believe that using the military to help with mass deportations, militarizing the southern border, making it harder for individuals to find a pathway to legal citizenship. Let's remember, Joanna, this country is made of immigrants. And the rhetoric that is being used by the Trump campaign, saying that they have absolutely no idea what Project 2025 is, that they were not involved. Well, let's just state the facts that 28 Trump loyalists that serve under his administration out of 38 were the ones that worked on this project. And so for me, obviously, you know, those are the facts. We know that Trump has talked about it. Even Mr. Hernandez mentioned it in the campaign trail. So obviously this is a blueprint for Trump, God forbid he becomes president, so that the same what happened in the 2016, his transition process was very chaotic. So this time around, they're being smarter about it. But again, I feel that these policies, again, they're just to terrorize black and brown communities, again, instill fear. We know what our community members went through when Trump was president. And so, again, this is just reinforcing what we've seen from him all along.
And Chuck, what are your thoughts on what Dulce is commenting?
Yeah. You know, she's advocating for Sanctuary City and all this, but we've seen what Sanctuary City has done to Chicago. It has caused a lot of chaos in our city. We don't have the financial resources to take care of these people. So it's just really horrible that we're advertising, come into our country, come into our city, we'll welcome you, we'll give you free health care, we'll give you free education, we'll give you free housing. The word is out and people are coming here. And we can't afford it. We can't afford it. It's pushing up the price of housing in our communities. You got in some of the black communities in our city and even in Hispanic communities, you got these outsiders coming now, these migrants that are guaranteed housing with money from the government. That is pushing up the cost of rents in these inner city neighborhoods. So that's hurting people that have been here in our country and live here, our citizens that are paying taxes. The America First Agenda.
Is this coming from personal experience? You said you were a former cop. Are these things that you would see in the field?
Well, the things that I've seen in the field are also the flood of narcotics coming across the border. I've seen fentanyl. I've seen the overdoses. I've had to investigate overdose deaths, and I've had to go and drive out to a young person's house and knock on the door and inform their mother, I'm very sorry your son has died of a drug overdose. These are the kind of things that we need to secure our border. We need to get back to being serious about the law in this country and enforcing our law.
And I want to talk about ICE. Project 2025 mentions a stronger presence of ICE. What role do you think, Chuck, they need to play?
Well, part of ICE is enforcement, right? The E stands for enforcement. And we have not complied with ICE here in Chicago. We have not complied with enforcing immigration, and we need to get back to enforcing that. We are going to have to deport, especially the criminal element that is here. Not everybody comes here with the purest intention. Some people do, right? They come here to work, to have a better life. But there are some that come here that have a criminal background. There's stories coming out of Venezuela that the jails are being emptied and they're being allowed to come here or being encouraged to come here to the United States. We need to put police our streets and know who is here and deport those that are criminals.
So what are your thoughts, what your approach that I should take?
Well, first I'd like to interject on the comments that Mr. Hernandez made about housing and how new arrivals are making it difficult for others to find housing and how the rent rates are going up. Housing has been an issue for many years, way, way before the new arrivals started coming to this country. There's a lack of inventory. There's a lack of equitable wages. So that's what we can attribute to these new housing prices not being affordable. Right now, even someone that's a middle-income individual can't even afford to buy a home, and that's because of the high interest rates. So I think that we need to state the facts. In addition to that, I believe that ICE has served more of, again, just to instill fear in immigrant communities. I don't believe that even that helps keeping communities safe, because if community members are afraid to call law enforcement when a crime is being committed, that doesn't help anybody. At the end of the day, it increases crime rates because there is no trust between community and law enforcement. And when we have law enforcement cooperating with ICE, then obviously community members are not going to want to have anything to do. There is no trust there. And so that actually makes it even harder to keep communities safe. The other fact is that we know for studies have been made that actually people born in the United States commit crimes at a higher rate than immigrants, newly arrived immigrants. So I'm just stating the facts here. I do fear that, you know, giving more power to ICE is just going to make our communities less safe.
And I want to talk about remain in Mexico policy that would keep asylum seekers in Mexico until their case is approved. Chuck, what is your take on this?
Yeah, I thought that was a successful policy that was implemented under Donald Trump. That was very successful, and that helped to make the border more stable. We were able to figure out who was coming in, look at their case, and determine whether they, you know, should be allowed into the U.S. So those are kind of common sense policies that American people are looking for. You know, we try to turn immigration into a real partisan issue, but you know, it's about the protection of our country and the protection of the American citizen. And under Biden and Harris, the American citizen is not safe. We can't afford this administration for four more months, let alone four more years.
What would it look like? What changes need to be made about the process to become citizenship? What about people who are in line waiting to become citizenship? What would that look like?
Yeah, it should be like it is for everybody else that wants to become a citizen. They go through the process. They fill out the paperwork. They do everything the right way. We should not be giving any kind of, for somebody that violates our law, we cannot give them the benefit. You know, they need to do it like everybody else.
Dulce, what are your last thoughts?
Well, unlike Mr. Hernandez, ICER and a delegation of member organizations and faith leaders, we did go to the border in Matamoros when Remain in Mexico was put in place. And we saw just the dehumanizing of mothers and children and living in squalor, some of the LGBTQ community being taken advantage of, sexually assaulted. And it was a pretty horrific scene. Again, we have to keep in mind that the United States has played a big part in foreign policy, and why these people are coming to the United States is because of the negative, you know, sanctions, economics has gone down the drain.
I'm sorry, that is all the time
yes.
that we have. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to leave it at that. Thank
no
you
problem.
Both for your input.
Thank you, Joanna.
Up next, how food recalls are pushing people to shop and eat local. Stay with us. For many, navigating how to lead a healthy life can be challenging. And after numerous recalls and reports of black mold, leaky ceilings, and flies at Boar's Head plant that led to a listeria outbreak, people are rethinking where they get their food from. Efforts to encourage local food sourcing is creating broader opportunities to address health equity. Joining us now with more are Weslyn Ashton, the co-director of the Food Systems Action Lab at the Illinois Institute of Technology, and Rukia Kirby Johnson, the vice president of Community Health Equity and Engagement at Rush University Medical Center. Thank you both for joining us. Now, this is a really interesting conversation. Nobody wants to talk about food recalls. And Weslyn, I want to start with you. Although many recalls are for undeclared allergens, does the increasing awareness of things like listeria outbreaks and poor production facilities say something about mass food production?
Yeah, so our food system is really dependent on these long supply chains, right? So our food is coming from all over the country and really all over the world, and contamination can happen at any point in that journey. And so there's a real awareness about those contamination possibilities along the supply chain, and it is increasing people's awareness and interest in more local sourcing.
Would you say that's something that people should be more concerned about?
Well, so I think in general, our food system is very safe, right? So the Food and Drug Administration has really developed a system where we can identify where contamination happens, what batches were contaminated, and where those shipments go to, whether it's in grocery stores, in whatever part of the country. So from a tracking and transparency perspective, the FDA does a great job of understanding where contamination happens. I think, you know, like the challenge is that we can't control when that contamination happens. And because of the length of our supply chains, it is likely to happen anywhere from the processing plant to the storage facilities to the grocery store.
In Rukia, some hospitals like Rush are also working to directly address things like food insecurity as part of a safety of staying healthy. How do you engage with the community to find out those needs?
So one of the things that we do, first of all, is understand that via focus groups, via being out in the community, working with community organizations, working with partners in the city and the county and such, to just understand where needs are. And then the other thing that we do is screen patients when they're in the hospital. So when they come in, we find out from patients if they're food insecure, basically asking a question, trying to understand if they have access to food over the next couple of weeks. And if we find that they are food insecure, they are given a prescription to our VeggieRx pantry under our Food as Medicine program. So they're able to get a prescription for healthy produce, proteins, and shelf-stable food. And then we also connect them with a community health worker who can follow up with them, who can also work to connect them to benefits.
And I want to talk about the hospital's new initiative, The Conversation, that started it. There's a billboard, right, that says, who gets the chance to be healthy? We all want the chance to be healthy. But what is that reality? What would you say is the concept of that?
Yeah, so that really came out of a desire to spark a conversation. We knew with the Democratic National Convention just being a couple blocks away that there'd be a lot more attention on Chicago and particularly the West Side. And so when we think about the need to have front and center this ongoing conversation about who gets the chance to be healthy, we wanted it to be big and bold and up there and continue to drive conversation with elected officials, with businesses, with community partners, as well as community members, and to think about how we can continue to engage with each other and think through new ideas and approaches to making sure or finding a way to help people become as healthy as possible.
And Weslyn, would you say that can locally sourced foods be a way to help slow this problem and protect people?
Yeah, definitely. So traditionally, our food system has sourced from very large producers. And I think the pandemic really highlighted the fragility of that system and created more awareness and opportunity for local sourcing. So here in Chicago, we have local producers from African American communities, from the Latino communities, who really stepped up during the pandemic to provide emergency food to their communities.
And would that include also getting into schools? What does that look
like?
Yeah,
so the pandemic kind of like opened up this box to say there are these local producers who are in the business of growing food, not just for a profit, right? I mean, everybody wants to be able to support their families, but also to feed their communities. And so since the pandemic, there has now been an infusion of more investment by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, by the Illinois State Department of Agriculture into local food and really supporting our local farmers who are, you know, not necessarily in the city of Chicago, but in suburban Cook County, as well as the collar counties, to help them grow their businesses so they can feed local, their neighbors.
And teaching people how to eat healthy, you would say.
Yeah.
In Rukia, we talked about, you know, there's a program that some of this local sources food goes into public schools. What would you say is the importance of having locally sourced food at schools?
I think there's, you know, sort of two positive sort of outcomes from that. One, it is a way and a means to help young people, children, get a closer look at food sources. It is a way to bring it to life for them. I know one of the things that we try to do is we actually have educators who will work with teachers to develop lessons to think about growing food, but also how healthy food can contribute to strong bodies and strong minds. And so, again, having local food producers help to bring all of those pieces together.
Well, thank you. I'll be following the food system and learning more. It's such an interesting topic. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, the holes in Chicago's recycling system. Stay with us. Creating 57 million tons of plastic pollution every year. That's according to a new study from researchers at the University of Leeds. The study examined plastic that goes into the open environment, not plastic that goes into landfills or is burnt. But what about local efforts to recycle that plastic? Our WTTW News Explained series explores Chicago's tortured relationship with recycling. Here's Patty Wetley with more.
Chicago may be a world-class city, but when it comes to recycling, let's just say it isn't winning any awards. The city's recycling rate has been stuck below 10% since 2016. How bad is that? Well, places like San Francisco and LA claim to keep 80% of their waste out of landfill. So what went wrong here? Let's take a deep dumpster dive. Flashback to the 1990s. Chicago's first try at recycling was the Blue Bag Program. Along with the usual charges of corruption, the program had a serious image problem when people saw blue bags of recycling collected in the same trucks as trash. Chicagoans smelled a rat. Was anything actually being recycled? Blue bags were scrapped, and fast forward to 2007 when the city rolled out blue carts, but only to residences with four units or fewer. Tough luck, high-risers. At first, blue cart recycling seemed easy. Instead of separating paper, plastic, aluminum, and glass, everything goes into a single bin. This method is called single stream, where the sorting happens on the back end. Single stream is popular because it's simple, but it has some major flaws. For starters, some people took everything goes a little too literally, tossing things like bowling balls and lumber into their carts, which, for the record, are not recyclable. Another problem with single stream is contamination. Contamination can ruin an entire load of recyclables. That's why the most successful programs separate waste. When the city tried to stop contamination, recycling got more complicated because lots of things can't go in the cart. Chicagoans smelled a rat again. Squeak. Is anything actually being recycled? The city has tried to take this runaway recycling train back on track, including a 2017 Back to Basics campaign and a new vendor contract. But is it too little, too late? the market for recyclables has plummeted, and the future of waste management is looking more and more like composting. Maybe this time, Chicago will get it right.
Hopefully we can get it right. And you can see more of our Emmy Award-winning series, WTTW News Explains, on our website. That's WTTW.com/News Explains. And that's our show for this Thursday night. Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And while you're there, check out our website for the very latest from WTTW News. And never miss Chicago Tonight. You can stream us on Facebook, YouTube, and our website. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30, 7, and 10 for the weekend review. Now, from all of us here at Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, I'm Joanna Hernandez. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy, stay safe. Buenas noches.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is committed to supporting diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives throughout the legal profession.